Okay, well, thanks, everyone. I know it's the end of the day, so yeah, we'll
have discussions too.
So you have the perfect subject for us.
We'll try to keep our comments brief at least. So today we're talking about paper 7A. The three topics outlined in the paper are collectability, constraints, and licenses. Those are the three areas where we received sort of a reasonable amount of feedback during the drafting process, including feedback on sort of whether those requirements in those areas are clear and that they can be operationalized. Now, the three areas are also interconnected, so I think it's good that we're actually talking about them all together today. When we talk about each topic, we'll just mention how they're related to the other bits and pieces of the other topics as well, so you have it at the front of your mind. Now, what we're hoping to get out of the discussion today is really just some direction from you in terms of which of these topics you want to talk about again in October. And you'll see, and we'll tee up the alternatives for each section, but again, very briefly, but we'll tee those up, and I think we're hoping to get a narrowing of those alternatives. So if we can sort of narrow it down to one or two alternatives that you want to think about in October, I think that'll really help us evaluate them further, bring back that complete analysis for you in October, should you decide that. I think that's all I wanted to say sort of overall. We might go into the issues now unless there's any questions or comments. Okay. Now, we laid out the issues in the paper by order of the standard, but actually just for fun, I think we'll reverse the order today. We'll start with licenses again. It's the one that we haven't talked about in some time, so I think it's probably worthwhile kicking off there. And also, it ties directly into the constraint, so I think the conversation will probably just flow that way. So licenses, the background and the feedback are in paragraphs 35 to 37 of paper 7A. You'll see some raised operational concerns with the implementation guidance on licenses, but also some raised a disagreement with the outcome that would result from a license. When it's a performance obligation satisfied at a point in time, and there's a sales-based royalty, for example, attached to it. And that is partly the interaction with the constraint. So the decision you took in July that even though we decided not to include that a paragraph from the 2011 AD, which is paragraph 85, so that exception for sales-based royalties, but when there is that sales-based royalty, if the performance obligation was satisfied at a point in time, an entity would be required to estimate that minimum amount. So it's the disagreement between the interaction between those two sections. So that's something you might want to keep in mind when we're thinking about licenses, because I think some of the feedback in the drafting process, and I think it's highlighted in the paper, is that I think some of the tension on licenses is caused because of the result or the outcome in the constraint for those sales-based royalties when the license transfers at a point in time. Now, there's five possible alternatives listed under licenses. They're just immediately before paragraph 38 in the paper. Now, obviously, you know, five is quite a few, so it would be good in particular to narrow these options down as much as we can. I think, you know, what in all of the options, one of the things the staff emphasized, I think in paragraph 39, is that we want to make sure in the drafting of these requirements, and something that we'll work on to improve is that we really want to make sure we emphasize that licenses, it's implementation guidance, so it's application of the model. And I think it's really important to emphasize the application of step two, in particular, the identification of performance obligations. That has to happen on all license arrangements. I think what the alternatives there really do is try to differentiate what you do then do when the license is distinct. When the license is a standalone license, it's not sort of put together with other performance obligations or other goods or services that transfer over time. And in those five alternatives, I think the first question that would help you sort of narrow those alternatives down is, you know, what do you want to do with those distinct licenses? Do you continue to want to make a distinction between two types of licenses, one being a right, one being access, which was your decision in November. So do you still want to make that distinction? And if the answer to that is yes, then that leaves you with sort of alternatives A, B, or E. If you do not want to make that distinction anymore, you want to treat distinct licenses all one way, that leaves you with C or D. So that's a helpful thing to think about, I think, when you're going through these alternatives. I think with that, I'll turn it over.
Anyone want to start?
This one worries me the most about our ability to come up to stay with a converged answer, just because the boards have historically come at this from such different perspectives. While I think the simplest thing to do would be to pick one, they're all access or they're all right, I worry that the two boards wouldn't agree on which one it is. And therefore, as hard as it is, I think that puts me into the camp of trying to pick between, what was it, A, B, and E, mm-hmm. As opposed to C and D.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I actually agree with that. I think that the distinction between right and access is correct for licenses. So I would reject C and D. I would reject B because I think there does need to be some information about how to separate. I kind of like the additional language you have in E to give additional criteria. That's kind of where I was leaning towards on this. And I think the real issue is not licenses per se. I think people are confused about how to do licenses because they don't like the outcome related to the constraint. But who's Daryl?
I agree with Mark in terms of the narrowing down. I would consider B, though, to just be sort of a give up. I don't think that's helpful. I consider E to be sort of taking A and actually doing it in a certain way, right, providing some indicators or criteria. I think we would need to discuss those quite a bit, though. You know, I'm not sure that I'm all that comfortable with the ones that are there in paragraph 43. Those all seem to be ones that we've talked about in previous iterations of this, and for one reason or another, they didn't seem to help us make the distinction. Mm-hmm. So, but I think probably, to boil it all down, I would probably head towards some variation of E.
I just wanted to clarify, Russ, you said you were in the camp of A and E?
I said it leaves me. So I reject C and D because I think they're different. B says they're different, but we're not giving you criteria how to determine. I don't like that. So that left me with A and E. I think E is the better solution because I think it's better to give more guidance.
Are they really mutually exclusive?
Yeah, that's what I was going to ask.
A and E?
Can you do both?
No, I don't really.
Do both.
I probably not. Both. You can do both, yeah.
I think so.
Yeah.
That's where I am.
Yeah, we can always make drafting improvements.
All right.
exactly. Tom?
I'm agreeable to most of what everybody said at this point. And it's not just that we can't get to agreement. After this long war about whether it's overtime or point in time, I think we've had this difficulty because truly there are some licenses that should be recognized at a point in time and some that should be recognized over time. And given the difficulty that we've had in being able to identify that, approach B would be a punt that wouldn't work remotely. Take away any thought process of being able to distinguish between those two and let them figure it out. Well, we've had a hard time figuring it out. So B doesn't work and C and D don't work. I'm an A and E person. I actually believe that we need some drafting improvements in A to at least minimally describe what activities are, because there's a confusion about whether there are activities that result in the transfer of benefits to the customers or other activities. And I think we're talking about other activities that help us decide whether there's a transfer to the customer or not and the timing of that transfer. And so we need to have greater clarification there. I'm interested in E, but I am not interested in exploring the indicators that are in this memo because I think the staff has gone down that road before, thought that wouldn't work, and really developed IG 33.2 as a way of bringing those all together in a way that makes some sense. Okay? I think we have to work on IG-33-2. That's part A. But I think I want to put something else on the table that isn't here yet. I was convinced in at least two of the outreach areas that I participated that perhaps when the original seller is paid based on the buyer's sale on to another customer, based on either a sales-based royalty or some other activity with the customer, that's an important issue that I think indicates that the license is an access to the original seller's intellectual property, separate from the criteria in IG-33-2, that it's the original seller's property given to the buyer. The buyer then has to go forward and do something else with their customer, and those sales define what the original seller will get. That seems like it's the seller's license that is being used by the buyer to generate another customer and therefore economic return and value to that the original buyer. That seems like access to intellectual property. And I would like to suggest as a modification to E that we fix IG-33-2. If you meet all of those criteria, it's point in time. But then add another one that says, and if you've got a partnership with your customer, the seller has a partnership with the customer where the returns based on that partnership activity, that's also a separate determinative indication you have access to the intellectual property of the original seller, and that sorts things out and limits this quasi-sales-based royalty exception to a decision related to licenses only and helping us define whether it's access to intellectual property or the transfer of a right, rather than out of the blue in the constraint having it come in play for only a subset of contracts, which doesn't make any sense to me.
Tom, isn't that 43C what you just described?
Yes, but this is 43C. 43 is a whole list of indicators. Mm-hmm. I'm wiping out everything but C and not making that an indicator, but a determination that there's access to IP.
Okay.
Let's go, PK. Thank you. I think the staff did it up very well in this issue about licenses. I think we should be careful. I think Allison said it well, that we need to put it in bold, bigger font, if it is possible, to put that. Before you do anything, you need to do step two. That is, you need to identify various performance obligations. So if that is done, I think a lot of tension will come down in this issue. The second issue which you touched on, Allison, but that is not the part of this discussion, is the discussion about sales-based royalties. If you do step two and you go to step five, then whatever is residual, you need to evaluate it. I think a lot of tension comes down in this area. I think we need to bear that in mind. I think I'm very heartened by the fact that people so far who have spoken have not resurrected issue C or issue D, which would be very detrimental to the project, because I think we have resolved in November of last year that you could have both. Now, coming to the issue about 33.2, which is the option B, and I will tell you why. I think Tom said he would remove 33.2 or supplement 33.2, do something with it. It's my suggestion is that when I read 33.2 and the two outreach meetings, and which I happened to share one of them with Tom, it was pretty loud and clear in that one of the outreach meetings, or two of the outreach meetings, that is pretty loud and clear. People got confused with the language in 33.2. What do I do with the word activity? And I think Mark was in that room and he had some philosophical question, which is Bill Clintonian style, what is ease or something like that. You brought up, and I cannot repeat your words, Mark, but you can help me.
TDR.
But, So I really think if I read this IG, I think first of all this is an implementation guidance. An implementation guidance by definition means it derives its existence from the main standard. And so anything, a wheel within a wheel, is a worrisome for me. And here there is some language in 33.2. One could interpret that is a wheel within a wheel. It's a model within a model. Talking about value, nature, things of that nature, and activity, defining what an activity is, how substantial it should be. I think we are unnecessarily getting ourselves caught in a trap. The people who were in that one of the outreach meetings, the auditors in that outreach meeting very clearly said, we can work with the model without 33.2, it's confusing us. The preparers said that the entertainment industry, which was affected by this, they said, we can work with it, we don't know how to interpret 33.2, which is causing us confusion. I think to start with, I don't mind, and I'll use these words very carefully, I don't mind letting the staff go on a wild goose chase one more time to find the indicators. We ran through it, we worked through it, we had comment letters, including the FEI, in July and May of last year, this year, talking about these are the indicators you need to consider. We went through all that, and we didn't come up with any one indicator that satisfies everybody. So unless there is a very clear direction, I'm extremely worried the staff is going to be let on a wild goose chase one more time. Because deep inside there is a simmering issue, what is a C, what is a D. As long as we don't get that cut right, I think we will keep on fighting around indicators. And I'm just saying that I want this in July, and I'm warning again that perhaps if you go with E, that sounds very good and drafting, it ain't be drafting. It is going to be so specific, the indicators, people are going to go back to their inherent positions of C or D. And I think we have to respect the fact this is an implementation guidance, and implementation guidance derives its support from the main standard.
So B?
I would remove B, which is causing the confusion, and if there is any improvements that need to be done, A, I will do it. I will do a combination of A or B. Unless I will go with E, I will respect E, but if people can say in this room today, these are the indicators we want the staff to work on. Tom proposed one, and it ain't working.
I think what PK is saying is he thinks he doesn't want to yet give up on the additional language or criteria to how do you differentiate right and access, but he doesn't have sufficient confidence we're going to come up with something, and so his fallback is if we don't figure it out by October, he'd stripe all of the implementation guidance related to it.
No, 33.2. If I remove 33.2,
okay.
Yeah, if I remove 33.2, I think the confusion which came about, which was in my mind and which was in the several, I will not say all, several of our outreach participants, is that we don't know what 33.2 is doing here. Explain to us what an activity means. Explain to us what is a value, what is a nature. We can sit here for another 2 years, I promise you. I will not be here, but we will sit here for 2 years. We will not resolve the fundamental issue. Ian?
Yeah, I thought you were pretty clever to translate PK there, Russ. I think I was an A plus E, and I quite like the indicators, except that I'd be prepared to concede if we can't get quick agreement on them, get them. And
concede, you know, to what?
If we can't agree on the indicators that are suggested under E.
Just do A.
Just do A, yeah. But if we can, and if they're useful, then, you know.
Just warning, Larry.
Because I always thought you wanted to bring something back that we had moved.
That is the constraint.
I come there.
Can I ask PK a question?
Yes, go ahead. Sorry, Larry.
How do you feel about Tom's suggestion? No indicators, but take the 43C and elevate it to implementation guidance?
Yeah.
But I thought Tom's condition included 33.2, which was a source of confusion. Tom was not relenting to give up 33.2, if I understood him correctly.
Yeah.
Is that right?
I don't think, if we can't decide how to divide it, being silent about how to pick what's being transferred will not be operable. And so I think improve 33.2 as much as possible, but the people that had a hard time in applying 33.2 and didn't like the conclusion, were only didn't like the conclusion because it did not consider when you have a partnership with your customer in their sales to their customer, They thought that that ought to be over time. And what I suggested was do 33.2, that's one set of criteria, multiple, that have to be satisfied over time. Or if you got that partnership arrangement with your customer's the customer has one with their customer and there's a sales base, that also says over time.
Yes.
And then some of the confusion that we heard about 33.2 will not be important because in the settings that they were concerned with, they would already be over time.
Tom, I already said that. If you do step two and you do step five, which is the sales-based royalties, a lot of tension comes down. I said that. But Tom's 43.C, Pat, to answer you specifically, also has payment terms where upfront indicates the license provided right. The first sentence bothers me. The second sentence in the 43.C is the sales-based royalties, which is a constraint. We are going to discuss it. The first sentence bothers me because the cash flow in general is going to decide except the sales-based royalties.
Yeah, but I didn't mean the first sentence.
Oh, okay. But that's why I did not support him on this one, because the second sentence that staff already teed up that we were going to bring up the sales-based royalties, and that's going to bring the tension down. So my worry, and I'm glad you clarified.
Give her another question. Allison's got one.
Yeah, and I think maybe this is a little bit of what you're touching on, because I think when you first started talking, Tom, I was thinking you were more 43E, which is it sort of gets to the partnership.
Yes.
But I
just thought Pat had pointed out the right paragraph, so I agreed with him.
Yeah,
Pat didn't point out my paragraph.
That's the question, though. If there is an upfront payment, a fixed payment plus the sales-based royalty, are you happy for all of the arrangement to be over time if there's a fixed plus a sales-based royalty? So, and that's important because I think what we're saying is that then control transfers over time, so all of the consideration comes in over time. Is that's the outcome you're trying to get to?
Well, I was thinking of the environment when there was all a sales-based royalty payment, but I think consistent with what we've already decided in licensing, that if you've got the license and bundled with something else, that's all over time, it's all over time. So if it's fixed for a license and over time, it's all over time.
Yeah, but okay. They're waiting for
you. Sure?
You
sure?
Wait, I want to say something first.
When Allison teed this up, she said there's a lot of interrelationship with the various topics we're going to talk about. So, and I think it's fairly obvious here. I guess Tom sort of teed up with his 43E or whatever it is, this partnership notion, which I thought was just another way of effectively getting paragraph 85, is it? Back into the thing,
but only for licenses.
You can do it various ways, but for those, there seem to be a lot of people who believe we should go down the indicator approach. How many of you were thinking about that, did so with the understanding in the back of your mind that we might perhaps reintroduce paragraph 85? Because I thought Tom was clearly, personally, I wouldn't describe it as a partnership or whatever. That's just, to me, that's just going to confuse people. You know, just call a spade and, you know, be done with it so people understand what we're saying. Because I don't think people will generally pick up and say, well, gee, I'm really in partnership with these people or what have you. Let's just have it like we had it before, if that's what people are thinking. But I don't know, those of you that have said that you're in favor of a combination of A and E, are you thinking about paragraph 85 and reintroducing it?
It was quite clear to me that if you give indicators between A and E and you put paragraph 85 back in place, people can apply that and know what's expected of them. But is it one indicator or indicators?
Well, I think the problem is we have to evaluate those indicators. You know,
Larry. Yes, I agree with that, but I crossed out indicators. E is described introduce additional criteria or indicators for determining whether their license provides a right or access. I don't want the indicators. That's what the staff went down the approach to get IG 33.2. I view the activity between the customer, your customer, and their customer as an additional criteria that helps us identify when there's a transfer of of access to intellectual property. And that's how I was defining EE, which is consistent with what you were saying.
Okay. So, I mean, when I support A and E or whatever you want to call it, it's with the notion that 85 comes back.
Philippe, did you want to get in?
Well, yeah, quickly, I think like you and like Daryl and just like Tom, I think C and D are out because I don't think a license is always black or always white. Sometimes it's a white one, sometimes a black one. I think we can improve drafting on this notion of activities because clearly from the outreach we attended, it's not clear to many people. I'm not opposed to having indicators rather than criteria. Looking at the list, I think there are indicators, but they are not absolute. I have some reservations, Tom, about the notion of partnership. We heard that at the outreach. I think in many cases it's a good indicator, but I'm not sure we can make it a determinative factor. I don't think the fact that your license is compensated on the basis of sales made by your licensee always means there is a partnership between the licensor and the licensee, which means over time. It could be an indicator, yes, but not an absolute determinative. I think sometimes you have a point in time and you are, in a way, with a variable consideration, but that doesn't mean that it's a partnership, because in a partnership you have to be active with your partner, in a way. And here you can be a passive, very passive. You can't do anything. You're just a passive investor, in a way. And a passive investor is not a partner, in my opinion. So sometimes you are a bit active, you have to do something, maybe minimal. Sometimes you have absolutely no way to do anything, so you have a passive, you're exposed in a way to the risk and rewards, but you cannot do anything to change your situation. So notion of partnership is a bit dangerous. I think sometimes yes, sometimes not.
Yeah, I think my recommendation is not inconsistent with yours. The staff's asking for things they should explore. And I'm just suggesting we should explore it. And the word partnership just came up because that's what was used in the outreach. Writing it's going to be a challenge.
Yeah, but I heard it also. My first reaction was to say, yes, it's an interesting idea. But thinking further, I said, well, wait a minute. What is a partnership?
There you
go. Now, I start with my hope to finish as early as possible. And I don't want to explore too much. And among the alternatives, I rule out as others CD first, and because as Philippe said, not red white. And I also rule out E, because all the indicators in E we already debated so many times. Like first one, term or non term, and obviously, you know, our board members and the FH board members have different positions. And secondly, the exclusive or not is the starting point. We start several years ago, but we changed from there. So I don't think C is the right way to go because it's so controversial. So then between A and B, I can live with. And BK mentioned about, you know, one of the controversial areas is sales-based loyalties that related to constraints. I think I will personally accept we change our decision last month, for example, without any minimum amount required to be recognized. I can change my position. But I don't agree with Tom to say that if it is self-space, it is access. Conceptually, Tom, I feel it is contradictory to our decision for in the lease standards, you know. If it is sales-based or usage-based, we say that clearly, you know, you should recognize as a liability. But the reason why we will not require you because of the measurement difficulties. So I will not, you know, contradict ourselves. I feel they are the same, you know, should be treated the same way. But as I said, you know, if sales-based is so controversial issues, I can change my position, you know, to delete the requirement to recognize minimum amounts.
Yes. Would you include paragraph 85?
Yeah.
Yes.
Yes.
You would.
What?
If we do what is proposed here regarding the licenses like which are like partnership, do we need 85? Maybe not.
No, we don't. I don't think Tom means partnership is just using a shortcut.
Yeah.
I think Tom is very clear that he doesn't want to chase what is a partnership, when is it a partnership, yeah. When is it a site.
His interest
is sales-based royalties when the revenue cash flow is dependent on ultimate sale to the third party. You got to wait for that to happen. That's the thing.
I understand. This deemed partnership, if we do that, we don't need 85 anymore. Because it is covered by that.
That's right. Yeah. That's right. That's why I think the staff brought this one first.
I think we should. I think from all the feedback we've heard that you've summarized here, that there are operationality and lack of clarity issues in this area. So we've got to do something. Can't do nothing. I think the point that you emphasized in your TIA, it's one of the things we have to do, which is probably captured by A, drafting, which is step two first, because I think some of what I've picked up looking at this is that there's confusion about whether IGA 33.2 causes you to reconsider, redo, recompile some of the assessments that you've made in terms of identifying separate performance obligations, which ones are distinct. So that confusion, because it's hard to map 33.2 back to that earlier consideration, creates, I think, genuine confusion about how step two and the IG for this particular category interact. And I think there's something we could do there. The other thing I think we heard is some of the other lack of understanding of 33.2 is maybe that activity doesn't work as the focal point of how you separate over time from point in time. Just activity as it is isn't enough. I think some of the other pushback that we've heard with people characterizing it as drafting or operationality or understandability is maybe just not liking the answer that comes from it. We have to filter out those. Now, in terms of which ways we pursue it, I think there's at least some element of A. In terms of indicators, if I step back and say the fundamental principle of the standard is when you transfer control, I think having an ongoing exposure to my customer's success is not actually about whether or not I've transferred control. It's more about risk sharing. And risk sharing is more risks and rewards rather than transfer control. Now, if what it is risk sharing, because I could, in a sales-based royalty arrangement, be absolutely transferring control of, let's say, ability to exploit a compound, in the pharmaceutical industry, or a character name, or something else in media, but let me stick with the compound and actually not have to do anything more, and I've given control, but I've taken. I've taken economic risk sharing. You don't have to agree, pay me up front, or you don't have to agree a fixed sum that you're going to pay me. I'd like to have some upsides, and I'll take some downside. That's risks and rewards. And I think that has a desire to bring that in is creating some of the stress. And if we're going to try and do something about it, I worry about trying to characterize it as an activity or as continued a form of making this access when, as the one who developed the compound, I may do absolutely nothing, after that date. I don't see how that makes it access, the fact that I have reliance on your effectiveness at promoting a drug. But I think some of this discussion, this is where the constraint interacts very, very heavily with licenses. I think we should do A. I don't think we can just pull out the criteria / indicators that we have. I think if we want to explore whether reliance on your customers' sales gives you some different kind of recognition of revenue, we should think about whether we're doing it as risks and rewards, as an exception to the to the control principle.
I don't think that risk and rewards is separate from control. consignment inventory, just because someone physically has it, doesn't mean that the original seller has transferred the benefits to that party. Benefits aren't defined until that second party actually finds a customer. And then that second party gets both the power over it and the benefits from it. So I would put it in that context that control requires both. And in these subsequent sales circumstances or subsequent relationship with the second customer relationship, the first customer of mine, the seller, doesn't get the benefits. I haven't transferred the benefits until something else has happened. They just have physical possession.
I want to think about this because rather than saying, yep, A and E, I mean, I think definitely A, I would really like E, but I want us to think about what we're doing, you know, and have those the kind of consideration, the back and forth we've just had. Is it really about control? And if it is, why? Try to bring them out in whatever is crafted. Yeah. And like others, I am not keen for redebating the decisions that was made about summer, you know, summer over time and summer points in time.
Gary, then we'll wrap up licenses.
I'm in, I guess, bucket A, or to work on drafting improvements. As I look at paragraph 33.2, actually, I think it's pretty good. I mean, for most licenses, whether it's a point in time or access over time, I think this gives fairly good guidance. And can you improve drafting? Just say, Russ, of course you can always draft it, but I think most of the time I think this gives pretty good guidance as to which way someone should lean. There'll always be a 10% transactions in the middle that could go either way, and we're never going to be able to solve all of those. So I vote for A. I think we need to acknowledge that anytime you don't give up legal title to any asset and licenses making it available, there's always going to be, you know, sticking to the control transference criteria is never going to be 100% achieved, because as long as you own something, you have not given up 100% de facto control. I think we should just recognize that that's just going to be a limitation of wanting to record revenue when you have not given up legal title to the assets that's involved. So I vote for working on A, drafting improvements. I don't think I'd go to spend much time looking for alternative indicators or something, because again, I think this is operational and, you know, most of the time.
Al?
This is a quick question. What you think about drafting, did you go down the rebuttable presumption approach and ask yourself, you know, if it always is over time, and then when would it be point in time, and then reversed it? Would that help define that line a little bit better? Because I keep hearing the same issues over and over again. Did you go down that process?
And
yep. Okay. I'm sorry, because I don't remember that.
We've been around the block quite a few times.
Let me. This is what I hear. Okay. I hear we're not selling any tickets to B, C, and D. And what the debate really is, we all think we can make drafting improvements in A, and what the debate really is what do you want to do with sales-based royalties when they're related to licenses? So I would propose that right now we have the staff focus on drafting improvements in A. Let's have a debate about constraint, and then let's see if we want to deal with this in the constraint or if we want to deal with it in licenses. Larry?
Could when the staff comes back to us, could you just take 5 or 6 typical licenses on both sides, if you will, and evaluate what, let's say you have a staff proposal, what the outcome would be with the staff proposal so the boards can assess whether they agree with those outcomes? Because, I mean, while we had a converged solution before, if we took those 4 or 5 examples and asked people on both sides of the Atlantic to respond to those, I think we would have gotten very different assessments as to what the license represented. And we can't come to that point. We have to come to, you know, a decent amount of unanimity in terms of how we evaluate the application of whatever guidance we put out. And at the end of the day, okay, people are going to disagree. We all need to realize somebody's going to change, okay? And we need to just face up to the fact that somebody out there, we don't know who you are, but you're going to change.
PK, then we got to move on because we got two. The point is that it's a drafting, but the issue that we need to consider is that we have heard in space, in, at least in my mind, from the 33.2 creating confusion. So if you want to do drafting, that's fine, but how do you define it is going to be a tension point for the staff. And I'm not trying to speak on behalf of staff. If I am staff, I would do that. Like, tell me, I heard this, what is an activity, what is a value, what is a nature? Mm-hmm. You know, those things will create, and I just don't want to punt, to kick this ball down the can. And I'm being nasty here because we're kicking the can down the road and it's going to come up. Like he, like Larry said, put six examples, he'll come and hit you in your face. I can tell you these 22 members here cannot come to unanimity or majority to one decision because people will decide. And I think the practice says very clearly, leave it to us, we will do it. And they're not trying to do anything funny because it's impossible to get all of them together. It is an implementation guidance. It is a derivation from the standard model. Remember that. 33.2 creates that issue. I belabored on it. I'm going to keep quiet, but I'm just warning you all.
I don't understand your point. Your point seems to be nobody can distinguish between right and access, so we shouldn't either.
No. I said that. I said that. I did not say that. I said 33.2. I did not say 33.1. I said 33.1 acknowledges that there are two types.
Right.
33.2 further elaborates it and tells you if you do an activity. If you do something to increase your value or nature of it, it sounds one way. Okay, I don't know which way it goes. And people are confused with it. An example I heard is very simple. I give a license to somebody in Turkey, okay, and I advertise in the United States. Is that an activity that is enhancing my work in Turkey? What is that activity I need to do it? What is this value or nature? Is it, am I doing it for my benefit or for the benefit of licensee? Those are the questions that come up if you read that. And Sue Cosper is nodding her head. Those are the issues that you cannot resolve. You're putting it there, and that is creating more confusion than anything else.
So what is the way forward?
I would suggest delete 33.2 and highlight that, like so, that Allison mentioned, clearly mentioned, first of all, you need to do step two. You cannot get into this discussion without doing separation criteria. And that is referred back to Para 29, the distinct performance obligations. That's where it is. Then look at this particular item that you have after you have done the separation and see if you have any ongoing that you cannot separate. If you have ongoing commitments, it's over time. I am not disputing with it. And I don't think 33.2 gives you that. It gives you more confusion. That's all I'm trying to tell you.
Dr. Mary?
Now, I have a slight different view with PK. You know, I agree with PK. You know, 33.2 create confusing. But when we discussed the examples maybe last year or earlier this year, I always say that there must be some kind of significant test over there. Otherwise, you know, you can point it out to any activities. So I always say the weather. Such activities will significantly increase the value or impair the value to the customer or others. And I think if we can, you know, introduce the notion, we have such notions, impairment and other of the classification measurements also. And I feel, you know, you totally delete. People still come back, say, if something there, how? Yeah. Should I take into consideration or should not? So I think when I discuss those examples, I always say whether it will create significant value to you or impair significant value to you.
Mary and then the staff has a plan. Maybe altered based on Mary's comment.
I just comment that I think PK's proposal is I disagree with, because I think it is the recipe for how to get to inconsistent industry-based practice that doesn't answer Larry's question about who has to change. I take the caution that activity hasn't worked, that it's going to be very difficult, and we think we tried all known paths, but I think we have to do something to filter out what is the disagreement from the giving at least some indicators so that it, we just don't get everybody continuing to do the same thing they're doing, at least in the area of sales-based royalties.
That was the staff's plan. Excellent summation, staff's plan.
Thank you, Russ.
Right? Okay. Can we move on to constraint?
Yeah, thanks, Russ. So, in terms of the constraints, the latest wording of the constraints is starts at paragraph 15 in the paper. The latest wording of the constraint that reflects the board's most recent decision sits in Appendix 8 of this paper. We've summarized the feedback that we heard from those outreach meetings in paragraphs 17 to 22 of the paper. I'm not going to summarize it further because it's already summarized, I guess. But we did break it down into kind of maybe the two main messages that we heard from respondents there, and that was feedback on the overall clarity and objective and application of the constraint. And then secondly, specifically feedback on the board's recent decisions related to minimums, which was, you know, to the extent that the entity doesn't expect a significant reversal, you would always book that minimum amount. And the deletion of, I think, what we're all banding around is paragraph 85, which was the specific guidance for sales-based royalty of, on a license of intellectual property. In terms of the possible paths forward, that's in paragraphs 23 to 34 of the paper. And I think we, try to break it up similarly to the way that we heard the feedback. So overall clarity of the objective, and there we've kind of the two alternatives that we've got in that table are, you know, we retain the staff draft mainly and just try and, through drafting improvements, clarify some of the confusion around people, mostly preparers, being confused that this seemed to be a two-step or three-step process, and just trying to clarify that in practice you may not always necessarily have to do it that way. Or alternatively, 1B, to address some of the other confusion around folks saying they weren't necessarily sure what range of confidence or level of confidence they needed before they could book an estimate of variable consideration, somehow give people a better feel for that, what that is, either through more explanation in the basis or using some other different, more descriptive word maybe in the standard. Then with respect to what issue two, with respect to the minimums, first alternative is, again, we basically retain the external review draft as it is, so mostly maintain your decisions. 2B is effectively bringing back the notion of paragraph 85. So again, if you want us to explore that, we look at that and research that or bring back a more fleshed out alternative there. So it's a paragraph 85 notion. So it might not necessarily be the exact thing that we had in the 2011 EDN paragraph 85, but that would be the idea. So a specific requirement for royalties on licenses of intellectual property. And then alternative 2C is what we've called the predictive value approach. And that's... a bit of interaction there with issue one, and we've laid that out in the paper, because to the extent that you want us to explore that as an alternative, that would effectively be saying it's the structure would be similar more to what we had in the 2010 ED, which was saying when you go through the process of coming up with an estimate, to the extent that that estimate is predictive, you have information that means that estimate is predictive of the amount you'll be entitled to, you book that number as revenue. To the extent that you don't have that evidence or you don't have that information, you do not book anything. And obviously what we've said in the papers, if we did go down that path, that would obviously require a slight tweak to the objective of the constraint, because it would no longer be focusing on significant revenue reversals. It would be focusing more on what the objective was previously, which is, can you make a solid estimate of the number? If you can, book the number. If you can't, book nothing. And again, then if we were to go down that path, you know, again, we would explore options around reassessment, because I think then reassessment would become a key question for you in terms of deciding how you want to take that forward, because you might end up with an answer that's very similar to paragraph 85 if you wanted to go with that as an alternative to the extent that you did not want reassessments. So what I mean by that, for example, is on day one with our typical sales-based royalty example, if you had a situation where on day one the entity does not have information to be able to predict the amount of royalties it thinks it's going to get over the next 15 years, it doesn't book anything because it doesn't have that predictive information. And then there's a question around, do you want the entity to reassess over that 15-year period? There may come a point in time where it now has the information to predict the remainder of the sales. Do you want to say, well, doesn't matter, you failed on day one, so you carry on recognizing over time? Or would you be wanting them to reassess and actually true up at a point in time? Because if you go with the former, you may get an outcome that is actually very similar to paragraph 85. So I just wanted to point that out. And also, you know, there's an implication for issue one if you want to go with alternative 2C. Some folks weren't clear on how that would impact as well, how the objective is described. So with that, I'll turn it over to the boards.
Mark?
I think it's a question. My understanding of the issue two alternatives, so 2A sort of retains the requirement basically to, in almost all cases, have to try to estimate a minimum amount.
Yeah.
Right? That's right.
2B says, other than sales-based royalties, usage-based royalties, you almost always have to estimate a minimum amount.
On intellectual property, so usage-based royalties on intellectual
property.
Just
on intellectual property.
Yeah.
And alternative 2C changes the objective and says you don't always have to do it. So I'm wondering if there's something between 2B and 2C, because I don't think 2B goes far enough. I'm very, very concerned about the minimums and always forcing people to try to estimate a minimum amount.
So,
in fact, I only think you should really have a minimum amount in only like two cases. If there's an actual fixed contractual amount that you're going to get, or if you got into variable consideration and you ended up, you know, trying to decide between the most likely amount or the range, you know, the two ways you can get in.
Mm-hmm.
If you're in the range one, and you don't know anywhere within the range, no one part of the range is any more likely than another, then I'd say pick the minimum amount. Other than that, I don't want to force people to try to make to estimate minimums. I don't think when you do that, I don't think it gives the investor any real insight into the revenue that has been, you know, the control that has been transferred, that has performance in the period. I think it's just basically what you're giving the investor as revenue is an estimated amount. And then next period, you're going to true it up to another estimated amount, whether or not it reflects any performance or transfer of anything in the period. So I'm really trying to restrict the amount of minimums that you have to try to go about and estimate.
But isn't that what 2C? Isn't 2C saying that if you have...
Well, that's what I'm asking, maybe.
That's right.
So 2C is...
saying when you look at this transaction, have
but
you
it's not about trying to predict the amount. Well, I guess...
You have X level of confidence.
You have X level
the
confidence.
The ultimate amount you're going to be entitled to, you can predict today.
Yes.
That's what 2C is saying. What 2B is saying is that you can do that on something you can kick, but you can't do it on something you can't kick. And 2A says predict it. Doesn't matter what it is, predict it.
Okay. So I guess I'm much more in the 2C camp then.
Todd?
The question to 2B. So your intention is to bring back 85. So that means that you treat intellectual property as a special issue. So my question is, say, for example, things like a customer list, would it be the range of intellectual property?
Of what?
Customer list.
You sell a customer
list.
And you get based on that sales.
Sales. And then royalty. So is this intellectual property?
Yes.
I mean, that's a good question, Sakin. I think when we brought this issue back previously, you know, one of the cons or, you know, one of the disadvantages we noted of the paragraph 85 requirement was that it would require people to make the distinction of what they believe intellectual property to be and what the definition of a sales-based royalty is as well. So if you wanted us to explore this further, I think if we bring the paper back in October, we could look into that.
Isn't the cut is more like a tangible and intangible?
But
like, you know, customer list looks like an intangible.
Intangible.
Yeah, so...
But I guess the question then is, do you folks think that intellectual property is the same as an intangible asset?
Yeah. So
are they
so
the same thing? I think is what Tack's asking, really. But
if you just point out, you know, intellectual property, it would be quite narrow. But if you widen, do you have any plan to widen these words? I mean, in July, you picked up, staff picked up the example of mineral deposit. And the mineral deposit is not intangible. It's tangible, it's PPE. But you could make a contract sales royalty base, as much as you excavate mineral resources, you should pay 1% or something. So then, I think to bring back 85 could solve this issue, but I do not like rule-based to put this just on the intellectual property. If you bring back 85, we should think about the scope issue seriously. And actually, you wrote it in your paper. If you go down the path of 2B, you are going to come back with the scope. So as long as scope would be wider and reasonable, then in that case, I could live with alternative 2B.
Yeah, Russ, I just wanted to ask Mark a quick question, anybody else who favors 2C. Are you, Mark, in favor of having to do a reassessment of that predictive value, the question in paragraph 34 as well?
Well, if you go down that approach, I'm trying to think, you always have to reassess the transaction price.
Would you only do
I think you always have to reassess the transaction price in variable consideration, don't you?
Well, currently we've got that to say that, but I think
that's no different.
That's the question.
I think some people would say that if you're not predictive on day one, just follow the cash.
Yeah. Exactly.
Others would say is follow the cash until it becomes predictive, then do the additional amount.
Okay. Well, I mean, in that case, I would say if you're not predictive on day one, then I would say I keep coming back to like a sell in, sell through, Pat. Right, and I don't want people to have to on every.
Right, that's what I thought. So people who say 2C, I think they should just make that clear. I think you're leaning in that direction.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
Why should you have something different from all up front or all later? You're going to have something in the middle that I don't think makes any sense.
I may be missing some history on this. Apologies if that's the case, but I think when I read staff review draft, the minimums guidance, and then looked at some of the examples, I was surprised about the notion of doing a best estimate and then taking out all possible variability, and grew concerned that the number that resulted, I'll use the language that you have in 2C without supporting necessarily that had any predictive value, that it was a faithful representation of what you wanted to get. And I guess the basic question I have is, are we sure that this idea of taking out all possible variability is what users really were asking for when they said, you know, revenue that isn't subject to significant reversal? Or, and I'm thinking of an example that we have, I think it was in the staff review draft of books, and based on new author based on all the experience, think that they will sell 450 copies, and then we take out all variability and take it down to 250 copies to remove all possibility of variability. 250, if we believe we've transferred control, is not representative of what we think we will get. And I guess I struggle with saying 250 is good information about that transaction. Now, I'm using the book example, but I do think that there are differences, that distribution model matters, which is why I think tangible versus intangible. Access to that book, where ultimately I'm paid on the number of downloads, I think the different distribution model probably does matter from I ship 500 copies to Russ and he can return unsold ones to me. I think it's changed how some businesses operate. So I'm not that concerned about the having differences between returns and in sales or usage based. But I am concerned that the minimums idea with this take out all possible variability gives a number that isn't recognizable to either the users or the preparers as what happened in the period. And I'm really questioning whether that's what people really were asking for.
What would you rather see then? The example of the books?
Well, maybe let me not use the... I think in the example of books, I think I'd rather see the 450 than 450 books rather than 250 books.
And if they didn't have predictive information on the 450, would you have zero then until the actual sales came through? Because that's what 2C is.
Yeah.
Right. Okay.
Can I just ask whether 2C introduces the notion of fixed and determinable to some extent?
No.
I don't think
Why
so.
Does it?
If you have, determinable, not fixed, determinable portion of it, I'm using the existing GAP language, a fixed and determinable. I'm using this becomes determinable because you're increasing the threshold to very high. I just want to ask one question though, for those of you who are supporting 2C, how does that comport with the transfer of control model? Having said that, I know that somebody can say, "What? How are you doing for sales-based royalties?" I respect that, but generally, if you go for the predictive value approach, how does that comport with the revenue recognition model that we have, which is a control or transfer of control model?
Well, I think the transfer of control model applies. This whole thing is about variable consideration when you're not sure what the when you're not sure what the price is.
But if all of it is variable.
And you're
all again, if all of it.
Then it is,
PK, like I don't think this is trying to. I don't think what 2C is trying to do is say, get rid of all variability. It's just trying to say using the indicators that we had in paragraph 81 in the ED, right? If you don't meet those, stop. Don't try to then figure out what minimum amount might start meeting those. That's all it's trying to say. If you don't meet those indicators, and those indicators weren't at the highest level. They were just at a level that, you know, okay, this is going to be, it's based on actions by a third party, or it's based on the market changing. Don't try to estimate a minimum after you've decided that these prices that you're going to get are outside of your control.
So let me ask you, so if you do the 2C, would you also combine the 2B, or you will not have 2B at all?
I
think the difference between 2B and 2C is I think 2B is only intellectual property.
Right.
I think 2C is everything, including intellectual property.
Right.
Yeah, but your day one is zero. When you get the cash, what do?
You recognize revenue.
So,
what do you mean when you get the cash? For a tangible?
For if I go through 2C, I get a cash of $100 this month, okay? But ultimately, I'm going to get $10,000, but I don't know that number. If I get only $100 first month, does the 2C allow me to recognize 100?
Yes.
Because it would no longer be variable because you've got the cash flow, so yes.
So at least you'd get some information as an investor about somebody performed something. the cash went.
It's good cash.
If you start with minimums, nobody performed anything, and then you're getting
this
you're
is
getting
similar
money.
To the staff's proposal in the previous papers about saying that we will have predictive, but if cash comes, that is a...
I think the way we would explain it is when the cash comes in, it's no longer variable. So you're not really subject to these requirements anymore, so therefore you're recognizing the revenue. And maybe just a clarification. I don't think when you're saying, PK, you're saying determinable. I don't think in the way that we were thinking about C, you necessarily need to have a different confidence level from if you're stuck with the current wording and the constraint. That's I think that those decisions are... They're mutually exclusive. You could have the same level of confidence about a predictive estimate as you've got of the same level of confidence that you don't expect a significant revenue reversal. You folks could make the same. They don't have to be different.
So can I go on, Gary?
Regarding 2A, B, or C at the moment, I'm not actually sure where I would fall if we had to vote right now. But I think, Gary, you had said 2C, if you go to 2C, you really got to consider alternatives 1 about the confidence level. But I think that's also true under 2A. If you're going to book a minimum, if your standard was virtually assured, minimum would be probably virtually zero. Right? So I don't know if we haven't discussed if we're going to give guidance about confidence, more, you know, reasonably assured, more likely than not, you know, whatever. But I think the discussions under whether it's 2A or 2C, or they're inescapable without, you know, confidence, because you could have a predictive value approach that you expect. Well, how confident are you
right,
in
Gary.
That?
That's right. I think we would still be bringing back that question around, do you want to provide more guidance on what that level of confidence is, regardless of if we brought that to C.
The controller by background is that there's a, you think one of your jobs to protect the balance sheet, so therefore, you know, estimates of variability that still remain to prove themselves, your biases, and you try to minimize that number, but recognizing that maybe that should not always be the answer, but I think we got to deal with confidence.
Tom Lindsbauer.
I'm going to start with issue one, because I think the answers to issue one help us with issue two. I think I agree that we have to explore alternative 1A, that we retain external review draft with some drafting improvements to make clear when you don't really need a two-step process, but you will need a two-step process in certain circumstances, so we both make clear when we need it and when we don't. I mean, clearly, if what you do is a most likely outcome estimate that is got conservatism within the estimate about the downside, you're doing step one and two altogether. Stop. But if you're doing an expected value estimation with equal weighting of the probabilities upside and downside, you don't want that. You don't want the upside to have as much influence in this evaluation. I think you have to do a two-step there to become conservative. And if you're going to allocate the transaction price to multiple performance obligations using the unconstrained transaction price, you need a two-step process. In terms of alternative 1B, I'm a strong believer that you need a confidence level, because I think what we're telling people without it, that you will never have a significant revenue reversal, and therefore there's a problem and a lot of second guessing within the system. I would have a very high confidence level that it won't reverse, but there still remains the possibility that you could have a limited reversal at some time. So I would use reasonably assured, but that's maybe a little American-centric, so highly confident might be okay. But note, what I like is in 1A and 1B, we retain a downside focus to this evaluation. That is, we're really worried about having the revenue reverse downward. What I don't like about 2C is when it's predictive value, you could lack in predictive value because you can't estimate the upside. And I don't care about the upside in that estimation. I care about being able to estimate the bottom part of the distribution well. And so I don't like 2C in terms of predictive value if it gives you the ability to say I don't have it for upside. I don't care. So it's downside with high confidence. If I know the downside, that I'm not going to have a downside reversal with high confidence, would I be willing, therefore, to have a minimum? If I'm really confident that that amount's there, does it subsume the 2C discussion if we have a high enough threshold when there's judgment? Because in 2C, there's still a judgment threshold there, right? But I think it's the wrong objective. So I think if we go through the path of dealing with 1A and 1B, like I talked about, we might not have to address 2, because 2B, I think, as I said before, ought to be dealt with as part of the transfer of intellectual property. That is helping you understand when it's access to the license rather than a transfer at a point in time. That is, the usage-based royalties tells you you really have not transferred control. 2A refers to everything Mark was talking about, his old paragraph 81, which is now 56.2, which is all the factors that suggest that you might have problems in estimating of a high confidence of reversal. I'd leave it at that. I don't know. The open question to me is, if I'm highly confident that there's not a reversal, but I really had set that high threshold, would I permit a minimum there?
Permit?
Require a minimum in a high confidence setting, or do we say it has to be absolutely no chance that there's a problem in estimation?
You're never going to hit that.
You're never going to hit that.
You're not going to then give up on
right.
The point of booking the minimum.
So I go through this whole thing and do a better job on issue one, and I think we deal with the minimums that way.
But you would, in that result, you would get a different answer between tangible and intangible.
No.
You actually do tangible and licenses.
Yes. I would the licenses issue, I would move to the licenses and say.
The end result is you have a different answer for licenses than you do for tangible. Because tangible, you'd force them to book something. And licenses, you'd say, since it's over time, you're going to book it. You're not going to book a minimum.
I don't think I think we have to be clear that if you have the factors in 56.2 and you're not highly confident in all your estimates, you don't have to book something.
But the minimum, see, that's the critical point is I may get anywhere between 100 and 1,000, okay?
and I'm 99.9% sure I'm getting at least 150. I know I'm getting 100. I'm 100% sure of 100. I'm 99.9% sure of 150, and I'm 50% sure I'm going to get 1,000. The minimum says book the 150. What people say is that doesn't tell you anything, right? Mm-hmm. That's really what the crux of the question is.
Well, I don't think 2C fix your issue because it is a threshold issue too. It's predictive value.
What 2C would say is predict with 95% confidence what you ultimately will get.
How is that different from saying predict the minimum with 95% confidence?
I know I will at least get 150. I know there's no chance of getting less than 150. I don't know if I'm getting 160, 170, 180, but I know I'm getting 150. 2C says figure out what is the amount with sufficient confidence you're ultimately going
to
get.
Tom, I think if you go the minimum, 1B says. If you go the minimum route, I actually think you diminish the value of the financial statements. And the reason is I think that markets will go and try to do the predictive value. There'll be more whisper out there than there is emphasis on financial.
I'm not communicating well. No. What you're trying to do in 2C is the same damn thing you're trying to do in 1B.
Exactly.
Except in 2C, you're doing an upside-downside evaluation of estimation, and in 1B, you're doing just a downside estimation. It's the same thing.
I agree, but 2C doesn't have a minimum in it. Only 2A has the minimum.
If it's 2B, if you can't do it with sufficient confidence, you get zero.
2C doesn't make you pick within a range when you can't figure out the
right.
ultimate.
Right, that's the
point. And that's what people are saying, is if I can't get the ultimate, I don't want to pick within a range to figure if it's 150, 155, 160, 170, where do I fall off?
Yeah, but
that's not what 2C talks about, though. 2C says determine the amount you can predict with high confidence.
Right.
Which would be not zero in a range. It would be the minimum.
No, it's ultimate amount. It's ultimate amount.
Where did it say high confidence?
Well, I just picked a threshold. Okay. I just picked a threshold.
Yeah. So Pat McCallum, what 2C says, Tom?
Pat McCallum's next.
Sure. She's confused.
Maybe.
Well, now I'm thoroughly confused. But I was in favor of 2C for the most of the reasons that Mark cited, and so in the interest of time, I won't elaborate on that.
All right, Carol? Well, if through answering question one, as Tom alluded to, I felt like we could avoid question two or essentially get it taken care of, then I might be drawn to that. I have to think about that. I'm not convinced that that's the case, because I think we've tried this high-level objective thing, and that's why we keep getting the questions back, is people can't figure it out. So I think we've got to get to the detail level, which I think is where part two of this comes in. I think alternative 2C has some possibilities. What I like about it versus the minimum concept is it has a higher hurdle for getting into recognizing anything, sufficient confidence or whatever we would define that at. And I think that it's looking toward, can you, with that level of confidence, predict the ultimate amount? And until you can get to that point, you don't recognize anything. So I think that addresses concerns that people had with the minimums. Now, having said that, though, I think Mary brings up a good point that we still have to deal with this reassessment question, because I think another piece of feedback that we got that was very relevant was people didn't think that over time then in the subsequent measurement and updating of that those updates were providing useful information, right? So if we go down to C, we get to this sufficient confidence level of the ultimate amount. Once we trip that, we get to it. I mean, inevitably, that's not exactly going to be the amount, right? And so when do you update that? Do you update it only one more time when you're ultimately completely done?
That's my question.
And would that give people what they want? Or when you get a little bit more sufficiently confident, you update it for that? I think that's the big question. But I do think that 2C has some possibilities.
We go.
Not 2C, I have a strange question. First one is, in 2011 ED, I think the basic notion is based on predictability. And if we come back to predictive value, whether we will use all those, indicators in the future guidance? This is my first question. Second, in 2000, 11ED, we still have the self-based loyalty exception. Will you still have or not? And certainly, you know, some of us are talking about, you know, the if we follow C, will apply to all the transactions, not only limit to the intellectual property, am I right?
Yes.
If that is the case, my question to you is, what's the relationship between our possible decision here and our decision in leaving the standards over, you know, the cell-based or other kind of transactions? It seems, you know, we may lay down different requirements, you know, in meeting standards and the standard here. These are two questions.
Too.
There's three in there. So I think your first question was whether or not we'll keep the indicators currently, whether or not we, in thinking about this option 2C, I think the answer to that is yes, that would be in there in an entity's assessment of whether or not it has a predictive estimate. It would consider those indicators. With respect to paragraph 85, I think was your second question, whether or not that's still needed then in 2C. I think the difference between, and that's the sales-based royalty requirement, the difference between maybe 2C and what we have in the 2011 ED is that 2C is really looking at the, see, the 2011 ED, just before we had that requirement about the sales-based royalties, it said, if you've got predictive experience on a minimum, you book the minimum. And then it said, notwithstanding that, for a sales-based royalty, you don't book it. So where 2C is different is that it wouldn't have that minimum requirement. It says, look, you can either get a predictive number or you can't. And because it's going to say that, some of the thinking is that we wouldn't necessarily need the paragraph 85 because it's already built into the way that you're thinking about minimums and the way it would work. That's at least how we're thinking. And then there's the question of reassessment, PKS. But and then there's the question of reassessment. Then obviously if you folks make the decision that if you fail on day one, you don't reassess, that will give you the same answer as a para 85. Unless on day one, the entity for a 10-year sales-based royalty actually has predictive experience of the ultimate amount of sales of royalties they're going to get over that 10-year period, that would be where you might get a different answer. But otherwise, if there's no reassessment, you will get the same answer as you've got in the 2011 ED. If you decide you do want reassessment, then yes, there will be a different answer from the 2011 ED. But as we've said, that's something that we'll have to come back to you, and we've got some indications already now for how you're going with that. And then, Weigo, I think your third question is on intangible versus tangible.
No, sorry. The possible decision here we possibly have with the decision we have in the leading standards.
I mean, the way I always looked at it was that the sort of the paragraph 85 exception in the 2011 ED, although it's framed differently than the leasing, the type of situation that paragraph 85 dealt with, the sales-based royalty, was probably the closest analogue to most of the sort of variable rentals that a lessor would have. So there was a great deal of consistency there, because under RevRec you wouldn't have recognised those sales-based royalties, and under leasing variable rentals were generally excluded from the measurement model.
But if we change to something based on 2C, whether we were for the consistency or not?
Well, I'm hearing quite a lot in this discussion that effectively it might be done by a variety of different ways, but I'm hearing a lot that sort of says that the sales-based royalty type of situation is more likely than not going to be recognized rather than recognized.
My last question is, we spent about half a year to change from the original proposal in the ED to so-called objective, we have an objective reversal. And if we follow to see whether we still have the objective or not, it may not necessarily have the objective.
I mean, that would be a decision, as you said, if we go with TC and it's moving back to more of a predictive, can you have a predictive estimate of the amount, then yes, that would move away from this idea of a reversal. But then there's the question of how much confidence you want on that predictive number. So to the extent that you want very high confidence on that predictive number, again, that might get you to the same result as saying, you know, we don't want significant revenue reversals.
Gary, is 2C one that says, look at the factors in 56.2, make a binary choice. If you're got those factors, variable consideration, and the transaction price is zero. If not, then decide whether or not you can get a highly confident estimate of the amount and use that. Is that what 2C?
No.
If you can get a highly confident estimate of the amount you'll ultimately be entitled to.
Right. If you pass the 56.2 evaluation. So 56.2 says in these instances you can't estimate well, right?
Yeah.
If you can't estimate well, it's zero. Yeah. But if you pass the, you have, if you're in a situation where you're better off in 56.2, where it's estimable, then limit it to the highly confident amount or whatever you're talking about as being the amount of variable consideration.
I think the idea is they would work together, Tom. So when you're trying to work out if you have sufficient confidence in your estimate, you look at those things in 56.2, and the more of them that you trigger, the less confident you would be that your estimate is predictive.
And so you'd be zero.
And then you'd say, actually, there's too many of these things, and I don't have that level of confidence in the number that it's that I'm ultimately going to be entitled to. It should be zero. That's kind of the idea that we've got then to see. Yeah.
Okay.
I can live with that.
Look, whether it's 2C or 2B, my personal issue is in the reassessment for usage-based royalties. Look, otherwise, it's let's not get confused ourselves with 2B. My issue is that the 6 or 7 comment letters we got post-July board meeting said that, look, by way you're explaining 2C means that if I have a 10-year license, if I have to do a reassessment, maybe in the year 8 or 7 or 9, the sales-based royalty people have to book a number. Okay, you get, for the first 8 years, you book it on a cash basis, in my example. 8th year, you book a one big block. Okay, there are two issues with that in my mind. One is it is subject to creative accounting. One, that's not the reason I'm saying that. Second is that it doesn't comport with the logic that you're using for the first 8 years. Let's remember that. So if you want to be consistent, and users have told us very clearly post-2011 ED that this model that you have for the Para 85, once you make the determination, you are on this path till the end.
No reassessment.
No reassessment. That's where, see, let us be very clear, between 2C and 2B, that's a fundamental issue. Mm-hmm. And my worry is that if 2C is done, and I think Daryl mentioned it, is that, how do you deal with the reassessment? And we got to deal with it right now, not wait for the next board meeting. We got to tell it this board. I think the solution that Tom came about is to insert 2B language into the licenses, takes care of it. One solution. Either you do 2C or 2A, that's a different issue. But you move this confusion away from it, then you don't need to deal with the reassessment. Everybody else is reassessment except licensor situation. And that is in the license situation. That's something good. The moment you introduce otherwise these logics, you will be exposing, and you will get another round of comment letters. This is a never-ending process if you put 2C.
We haven't yet answered
it. Without being very clear what we want to do till we wait for next month.
Okay, 2C and 2B can be the exact same analysis, but it's just a matter of scope. 2C, the board could decide that 2C is no reassessment. If you
I said the same thing.
Yeah.
I think you decided to paraphrase my Indian accent.
But I think the debate between 2B and 2C should be about, do you want this constraint to be different between licenses and inventory, or do you want it only related to licenses?
You can approach this problem on a global basis. That's not a problem. That's a fair, because it solves the sell-in, sell-through problem. I completely get that. But where I am worried is the reassessment issue. No. And if you guys agree with it, I will go with it.
I'm saying 2C, we can take reassessment off the table.
Yeah. Well,
but Mary?
There's something in what PK just said that I think is a problem with how different models would apply. If you have a license, that's a single transaction. So I don't think you'd have the cash you collected until you could get to an estimate. Because if what you're trying to do is estimate the single transaction price, there's no basis for recognizing the cash that's come in as revenue, even though it's absolutely certain. Because I have a single transaction when I've licensed. IP. Different answer on the books, because as each book sells, you could view it as a sale of that book, you know, different unit of account. But I don't think we can take a model that says predictive value or minimum level of certainty and say, but of course you'd recognize the cash you've already received as revenue when you have a single transaction.
Right.
So,
right.
Because there's so if it's IP, single transaction, I've licensed you the right to let people download a book.
Right. No, the issue is variable consideration, right? And so as the sales come in and you actually get the cash, the variability goes away. So why can't you then say I've got the transaction?
If your objective is to estimate, you know, a number for the transaction, and there's one transaction, the cash that you've collected to date is not the ultimate from the 10-year agreement.
I think what you'd have to say, notwithstanding that, get any cash distributed ticket. Yeah,
well, that's
what I think you'd have to say is that when it's not predictive, you do to take the cash into consideration when the cash comes in. And on the one transaction with the inventory, is I would deliver you 500 books.
Yeah.
That'd be the transaction. Yeah. But then if I can't predict the ultimate amount that will come back, I'd recognize revenue
as
each book.
Right. And that's, I think, one of the differences between physical and intangible and the license. And so in some ways, I think that drives more to Tom's answer of don't try and contort what we're doing to with the constraints to deal with concerns that maybe could be dealt with as
well. But 2C, if you cut down reassessment for everybody, you're moving further away from the revenue recognition model. I think the 2C inherently should have reassessment.
Okay, let's hear from Martin and Philippe, and then we can figure out a path forward. Martin?
Yeah, I also thought maybe 2C is a good solution, but I think then you have to come up with, okay, when do we think an entity can expect to have a good estimate or not? We have to come out with these rules. And I thought my understanding of the problem was it is especially a problem for sales-based royalties. And then we have discussed last meeting, do we have a different model because we had this exception for licenses but not for others, and why is that? But if the problem is really sales-based royalties, why don't we give this exception then for all kind of sales-based royalties? If it is a license or another product, I would not care. And then giving them to the entities an accounting policy choice, saying, okay, because we think it is maybe difficult in this situation, and then you should have a policy choice. If you think you can good estimate, then you should do it on an estimate. If you think you can't do it, then do it on a cash basis. And that, I think, would be the solution for this problem, and not to make it bigger than it is. Because if the problem is sales-based royalties, and some think, okay, why is it different from licenses to other products, I would say, okay, then make the exception for sales-based royalties, but then for all kind of products. And then do it as a kind of an accounting policy choice, and people should then disclose what they have chosen, because maybe they cannot estimate, other can estimate. I cannot judge if people can make a good estimate and reassess or not, but I think that is a way forward from my perspective. Because if the problem is sales-based royalties and not others. Because when if you do it 3C, then we have a lot of other things which we have to deal with.
The more I think about it and the more I hear about it, the more I am attracted by 2C. And the less I feel that we should make a difference in accounting between intellectual property or intangibles and tangibles. To me, there is no difference in nature when the consideration is variable and contingent upon a customer's sales or a customer's activity like usage. I see no reason why we should make a difference between tangible assets like a machine. I'll sell you a machine and you will pay me a percentage of your output. It's a kind of partnership, as well as I sell you a license and you pay me based on your sales. So I think I would align the contingent revenues on the same basis, whether it's tangible or intangible assets. So I think that introducing paragraph 85 makes an exception, a rule for intangibles, which I don't think is necessary. 2C, I think, is more straightforward than the other one, 2A, with the minimum, the two levels, which people are very confused about those things. I think 2C is more straightforward. Now, let me come to this. I think Mark said reassessment, or someone said reassessment doesn't provide useful information to investors. To the contrary, I think a reassessment does provide useful information. Yes, the entity has done nothing. It has not performed. It is passive. but there is an event which is that your level of uncertainty goes down. That is an event which must be recognized. The fact that your confidence level increases should be recognized in the financial statements. It has an accounting consequence. You can book revenue that you couldn't book before, and maybe you would have just disclosed that you had an amount which you did not book because of uncertainty. Now your uncertainty goes down, you can book it. That is an event of the period which must be recognized and given effect to in the financials.
Chang Ho?
Yes. So dear, just a clarification. So generally, if we go to the alternative 2C and the alternative 1B, then as we were pointed out before, we are almost going back to the 2011 ED, paragraph 81 to 83. So is that right? My observation is right.
That's right, but there'd be two quite important differences. The one would be that we would provide, or the boards would provide, a bit more clarity on, in 2011 ED, we used the words reasonably assured, which was just a placeholder. 1B is proposing that the boards would clarify the kind of confidence level that you're intending for the constraint. And the second thing is paragraph 1 to 83, but 84 and 85 really dealt with the minimums and the sales-based royalty, and 2C would deal with that slightly differently because it would say, don't book a minimum if you don't have predictive information on any number in the range. And therefore you don't necessarily need paragraph 85 to tell you, even though we just told you that for a sales-based royalty, you don't do that. So,
if the observation is right, I'm a little at a loss because past 1 year, you know, we have talked about everything has changed, but all of a sudden we go back to about 2011 ED. So
let me propose this so we can maybe make more progress in October. I don't see anybody or hear enough support right now to continuing progression on the minimum. That is 2A. Is that right?
Right.
Okay. I do hear differences of opinion between 2B and 2C. So I'd propose the staff could research and put together in front of us for October views of 2B and 2C, both with and without reassessment. And now this is the other key question, is with respect to issue one, do you want that analysis based only on a 1B thought process, which is some level, reasonable assurance, something like that?
Yeah.
Is that what I'm hearing?
Yes.
Can we do 2C without doing 1B? I think if we do 2C, you need to know what level of assurance is necessary.
Right, that's right. I agree. So what the staff will put in front of us is 1B and an analysis between 2B and 2C, both with and without reassessment.
Russ, is there much support for 2B?
Well, PK. 2B, I'll tell you what the support is, though. If there is no reassessment...
Then you go for 2C.
If there is no reassessment, it's the same. But you will not...
Ask how many are in favor of 2B.
You are not solving the issue. The reason I didn't take 2B off the table is, honestly, the analysis between 2B and 2C is not... I don't think it's all that difficult for you to do, right? It's just a matter of scoping. So, in other words, what I would see the memo to be is, This is what the threshold for 1B, and then 2C we talk about the predictive analysis, and then you get to, do you want to do it with or without reassessment? And the last question is, now that we've figured out what's the scope, is the scope only intellectual property or is it all transactions?
But can't you do that just looking at 2C and taking 2B off the table?
It comes automatically. The moment you say there is a reassessment, if there is a reassessment, then the people who have written the comment letter is that they don't want to get off the cash model, and there is a lot of, and users told us that they like that. Users told in 2011 ED we are going over the users VD.
I think Ian's point is, I think what Ian's challenged me appropriately is there doesn't appear to be sufficient people lobbying for 2B. So
why are we wasting our time with it?
Okay. This is the second time I'm predicting again.
Do you want to test that? See how many people would first preference to 2C? Yeah. So just tentative. How many ISB first preference 2C?
Yeah,
no reassessment.
Are we always out?
Second question.
That's going to be the issue.
Russell, I think one thing you're missing.
Yeah.
That is, you know, you just say that we.
he wants to see consistency between, you know, intellectual property or not. I mentioned the relation between this one with leasing. And within leasing, the variable lease payment, we clearly say if it is sales-based,
right,
usage-based, not recognized at all. But here, if we follow to see at all, it seems you will propose differently. Am I right?
Yes.
I will feel, yes, you know, sales-based loyalty will still be an issue there.
Why? Say you don't take sales-based royalties. So why do you think that's inconsistent where we are on lessor account?
2C says that don't take sales-based royalty?
Well, I think
you have to put the reassessment you will take. That's the issue.
Well, I think Weiguo is saying on day one, if 2C would say, even if it's a sales-based royalty, if you're a lessor, if on day one you actually were able to predict the sales that lessee's going to make, you would record it. And I think Weiguo is saying that's
possibly
inconsistent with the leases. The leases is like, it doesn't matter if you've got the information.
So my point is, all the analysis and research we got is they can't predict it.
Correct.
So the end result's the same.
No. Wow. But if you don't predict under release, you don't book it. Under release, you book it.
I would like to see the assessment of both.
Yeah. Both 2B and 2C with and without? Okay. All right.
I'll give him.
So let's do that. Now, what do you want to do on collectability?
5 minutes.
It's not a 5-minute discussion.
I mean, we could continue, although I've already delayed one thing and I need to go, but, or we can do it tomorrow morning. What do people want to do on collectability?
We're too tired to take
questions. We'll just start with you want to start with collectability, you want to end?
I collect tomorrow morning.
Do you want to start earlier?
Let's see.
Guys,
you made progress on your idea, Siegel. You just might have lost it all.
Okay, so we'll start with collectability. Don't feel you need to get up for it. The people on the screen, okay?
You're going to start when, sorry?
We'll start at 9 with collectability.